How's it going, everybody? You're listening to Treetop Talks. This is Jay.
This is Andy.
And today, our topic is going to be trees as a food source. And it's going to be a fun one, and our species highlight is the Ohio buckeye, Aeusplis glabra, from the Hippocastanaceae family. So, let's dive right into it, Mr. Sherwood. What do we got for him today?
Yeah, well, actually, real quick before we get started, you want to introduce that music you got
playing? I keep forgetting to do that, don't I?
Yeah,
so this is the Grateful Dead acoustics. I don't own this music. It's not mine.
All right. There we go. No trees.
Legal stuff handled. Now on to trees.
Yeah, well, let's start with just a little bit of background history about how trees acted as a food source back in, you know, back in the ancient days.
Back in the Mediterranean basin, thousands of years ago, they had the first recorded fruit trees. You know, archaeologists found remnants, and they suspect that people were cultivating these trees as a food source. And then you see that progress throughout the times over in the European nations. There's great evidence of olives and fig trees, stuff like that, of huge importance back then. Also, some of the fruits we know today a little bit. What do you think of it?
Apples were right around that
apples
area.
Apples have been around for about
Although,
that long.
What, you know, the interesting thing about that, apples specifically, and other things in that family, that's the rose family, is they weren't able to grow those commercially for a really long time because they were limited by propagation. So they couldn't really root those, and they're still hard to root by cuttings, the normal way of propagating plants like that. And so once they figured out how to graft plants, that's what really opened that door up to all the rose family plants, apples, plums, you know, else in that
all that
family?
Stuff.
A whole bunch of fruit crops. All the stone fruits.
Yeah. So then you have this propagation of fruit trees, and then the European settlers came over to America or invaded America, depends on your point of view. And then when they did that, they brought these fruit trees with them, and they started propagating them here. And eventually, this led to the mass propagation of the fruit trees in the southern United States that we now see today.
Yeah.
Also, the northern United States. Each area has its particular tree of interest for fruit, and that I'd say it's like that in almost probably the entire world.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know, where trees can be grown and used as a food source.
Yeah, absolutely. Every place has some tree that it can grow and use. I mean, in Wisconsin here, you know, we have, you know, we got a decent apple industry, and cherry industry is actually pretty big over in Door County of Wisconsin. But also, we hadn't really thought of this before maybe, but if you think about maple syrup as a food source,
yeah,
and that's definitely coming from a tree. That's from the sugar maples, and that's a huge industry in Wisconsin, much bigger than up in Canada. And
yeah,
you know, that's just one prime example of a regional thing. Is, you know, we can't grow those temperate fruit crops that you typically think of, but we can still use trees as a food source up here other ways in addition to the fruit crops that we can grow. But yeah, just some interesting things there.
Yeah, so what's next on the list there?
Well, let's talk about pollination a little bit. It's a really important factor when considering planting trees in the yard. If someone wants to grow some fruit for themselves in their yard, and a lot of trees, not all fruit trees, but a lot of trees need to be pollinated by another cultivar of the same species. And one big example of that is apples. Apples need to have at least two cultivars growing near each other in order to set fruit. Two different cultivars in order to set fruit. And without that, you just simply won't get fruit set. So that, I think from there, we can talk more generally about growing apples in your yard, do you think?
Yeah, let's move into that. So if you want
a little bit.
I actually had this conversation with a neighbor of mine the other day. He wanted to start growing fruit in his yard. And I go, okay, well, you know, what are you kind of looking for? And he obviously said, man, apples are great. And I go, that's a great choice. Do you know you have to plant more than one different species in your yard? He goes, no. And so I was like, well, that's where you start. You know, you pick two species, or if you don't want two different kinds of apples, well, you have two different cultivars, sorry. You can just put a wild-type crab apple in there. Great pollinator.
Absolutely.
That'll do the trick.
Yep.
But So the big thing with planting a fruit tree in your yard is you got to understand the amount of maintenance that this tree is going to need in comparison to maybe some of your other trees, specifically in pruning. Pruning is really, really important for any fruit tree out there, guys. It's imperative you get the pruning right. Fruit needs full sunlight to develop, and branches can sometimes shade out other branches, and your yields are going to be lower then. Same thing with wind. You got to have this nice breeze that can flow through the canopy, or you're going to start to see problems with diseases, and it's really just going to, you're not going to get as much fruit. You know, you're planting this tree there for fruit, for a food source. You want to get as much out of it as you can. And so pruning is probably a pretty big one. What else you got that would be a big issue for people with fruit trees?
Well, you're really going to need to use some kind of pest management strategy.
For sure.
Pesticides are the easiest way to do it. There are a lot of safe ones out there these days that, you know, when used properly, really don't cause much, if any, harm to the environment and no harm to the, you know, consumers of the fruit. So I think they are a decent option if they're used appropriately. But
absolutely,
for people that don't want to use pesticides, you might just have to accept a slightly lower fruit quality and probably lower amounts too.
You'll still get fruit, but yeah you're right. Going to take a hit in your yields. And mm-hmm.
You'll get fruit that just won't be the best fruit around, probably.
Yeah.
But another really important thing, I think, to consider when planting trees in a yard is the size of the tree. A wild-type fruit tree is 40 to 50 feet tall. And so to overcome that, they're oftentimes grafted onto a dwarfing rootstock that makes the tree only about 20 feet tall or less, even in some cases. And so it's just important to pay attention to what rootstock the tree is grafted onto. And that's something that the nursery that you buy your tree from should be able to tell you. Just
all
ask
that
them
information.
How tall
the
is the tree going to get with this rootstock combination? And they'll tell you exactly what you need to know for size. But it's just really something important to keep in mind. And similar to that, when we're talking about grafting, we can say if you have a really small yard and don't have enough room for two different cultivars of a tree, you can buy trees at, usually you can find them at garden centers, I feel, if anywhere, that you can get a apple tree grafted with two different varieties on it so that they'll pollinate each other. You can grow one tree in your yard and it still get fruit set.
It's definitely an option.
It's a really cool option. They cost a lot more, I think, because it's, you know, pretty labor intensive. Extra grafting that has to be done. So they're a little more expensive, but they're a great option if you have a pretty small yard and can't, you know, plant two different apple cultivars or something of that sort.
And I'd also like to kind of throw in there, we briefly touched on the pollination aspect earlier, and I'm going to revisit that a little bit. When we talk about apple trees and pollination, brings up the importance of bees. Bees play a pretty pivotal role in that, but
Absolutely, they can
also be, if you're in an urban setting, in an urban area, and you don't have a whole lot of bees, you can still plant these trees and you will get fruit off of them because a big majority of pollination does happen through wind. Naturally moves pollen from tree to tree. So, you know, if somebody tells you, oh, you can't grow a fruit tree in the city because you have no bees, how are you going to get pollination, etc., there, apple trees, you can grow those
you'll
in an urban setting, and you will still get yield.
It'll be lower, reduced compared to a high insect environment, but
correct.
You can definitely still get some fruit there. And not to mention, it's a good way to attract pollinators.
Yeah.
It's a cycle. The pollinators need plants to provide the pollen and nectar that they need to eat. So, you know, without the plants, we can't have the insects there.
It's a mutual benefit for the insect, mutual benefit for the tree.
Right.
It's just a good deal all around. But mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. So let's move on from that. You had a point you started on there. Why don't you...
Well, let's slightly switch gears here to bananas.
Oh, that's where we're
going.
Yeah. You know, let's talk about bananas then.
Yeah, this is something you want to talk about. Why don't you get us started off here?
So, those bananas you see in the store, guys, you might not be seeing them very much longer. So, the banana tree, which technically isn't a tree, but because it's such a pretty staple food source here in America, you know, every grocery store has bananas in it practically.
Yeah.
Every grocery store has the same looking bananas in it, conveniently. So,
yeah.
That's all one cultivar, guys.
Which, just to be really clear here, that means they all have exactly the same genotype.
Correct.
And there's no chance for a resistance to any pathogen. So, with that in mind, let's hear the story.
The reason you might not see those bananas anymore, there's currently this Fusarium wilt. It's caused by a fungal pathogen, and what that does is it creates this, it's almost like a mold, it's a fungus that grows on the tree and eventually consumes it, killing it. You know, this fungus just infects it, kills it, eats it alive pretty much.
Kills the tree to the ground, correct. Nothing left.
And the reason this is such a problem, because fungus is not a new issue with plants. We've been battling that since, you know, hundreds of years now. Since the beginning of time.
Since we've started cultivating plants.
The big issue here is there is no chemical control currently for this particular fungal pathogen, which means they can't just spray it with something and make it go away. They are basically just screwed.
They're powerless to this fungus.
Yeah, it'll come in and wipe out entire plantations because they are all the same cultivars, so they all are susceptible to this. And the options right now basically are you can either genetically modify this banana plant until it becomes resistant, and then grow it again, and you'll have a GMO banana, whatever your feelings are about that. Or you're going to have to get used to eating some different shaped and different flavored bananas, because there are different banana cultivars out there. However,
It would require crossing different wild species of bananas to try to domesticate a new cultivated banana that has the resistance, because it's currently not even available in the other cultivated varieties.
It'll be definitely different than the one that everybody's used to that's been around for 60 years, and they, like we said, they only grow that one. And we've talked about monocultures before. It's just not good when these pathogens hit.
Yeah.
So that's the banana epidemic in a nutshell for you. If you Google it, just type in banana disease on Google, and this will just pop up, and you'll
find it.
It's some pretty horrific images of all these plantations just dead.
Devastated.
Yeah. It's wiped out.
Yeah.
It's just not good.
But there's hope. We can come around this through plant breeding, as always, you know.
Always a solution.
Whenever agriculture or horticulture runs into a problem, you know, it's plant breeders to the rescue.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, we've come rolling through with the really nice genetics, and things are going to be a little different. Bananas aren't going to look the same. They're not going to taste the same, but they're still going to be good bananas.
Absolutely.
But they'll be resistant to this fungus is the most important thing.
And that's really where I'm not going to go on a rant on GMOs too much here, but what a lot of people, I think, are misled or misunderstand about genetically modified organisms in terms of plants is we do that because we have these massive problems with disease. We are used to food security, and you only get that through eliminating the presence of disease, because disease wipes out crops, kills yields, and has caused human displacement in history up until, even currently, it's causing human displacement around the globe. So what genetically modified organisms do is most of that is disease resistance. They change the genetic code of the plant to be resistant to a particular disease, and that's what's really driving that industry now. And I just think there's a lot of misconception about, oh, well, these genetically modified crops are just so terrible for us. And
well, I mean, the thing is it's just how they're being used.
Right.
You know, the herbicide type crops are, you know, a problem, but that's just that usage. It just allows them to broadcast herbicides at ridiculous rates. But when used properly, there's nothing wrong with making a GMO plant that gives food to people that wouldn't have the food otherwise. You know, it's different than just giving, you know, the big companies extra money because you buy their fertilizer and their seed.
I'm assuming you're referring to a company that we're not going to name, but it starts with an M.
Yeah, the big M.
Ends with Anto. And they are known for a particular genetically modified plant that is resistant to a particular herbicide that they also happen to sell and has really taken over the market, and that's what gives GMOs oftentimes a bad name.
That's what I think a lot of people jump to the conclusion.
It's still a small percentage of the GMO population. So.
Right.
that's the rant on GMOs. Yeah, we'll leave it at that. You can have your opinion. That's more than okay, but that gives you a little insight to some of our knowledge about the genetic modification of plants. So
that's a way to think about it.
With that, let's move into the species highlight.
Yeah, let's talk about Ohio buckeye. That's Aesculus glabra.
That's a goofy Latin
it's
name.
Yeah, I'm not even sure if either of us are saying it right.
We might not be.
Yeah, but it's spelled A-E-S something. It's
C-U-L-U-S.
Yeah, there you go.
It is part of the Hippocastanaceae family, which is fun because it sounds like hippo. And it's also commonly known as the horse chestnut family. And, man, this is a fantastic tree, Mr. Sherwood. Why don't you give them some of the describing features of this tree?
Okay. Well, let's start with the most recognizable thing. From this point on, you'll always recognize this tree if you see it. It's got these leaves that look almost identical to a cannabis leaf, if you can picture what that looks
almost like. Almost indistinguishable.
It's got 5 or 7 leaflets, the same number as a cannabis leaf does, and they're laid out in the same orientation, except these, the leaflets on Ohio buckeye are a little bit wider, a little bit fatter.
They're a little bit smoother too. They're not quite as hairy as the ones on the marijuana plant.
Right.
But if you took the two and put them next to each other and walked 10 feet away from somebody, it might be pretty difficult to tell the difference.
Yeah, a passing glance. If you see a tree with what looks like pot leaves, it's an Ohio buckeye.
It's a buckeye. Yeah.
Which, I mean, yeah, it's interesting. And the leaves are oppositely arranged on the tree. The tree gets 40 to 60 feet tall.
It's a fairly large tree.
Medium large.
It's probably not the fastest growing tree out there, but it's not on oak status. You know, it's
not that slow.
It's a moderately fast growing tree. Mm-hmm. It's going to enjoy... It prefers part shade to partial sun, but it will live in full sun shade, which is
fun.
That's pretty cool if you ask me. It prefers really well-drained soil. pH isn't a huge issue with this one. We talked about that in one of our last podcasts, pH.
I've been reading they like a slightly acidic soil, but they can tolerate a neutral or alkaline soil really without much of an issue. And they're actually pretty attractive as a small tree. So, I mean, considering how they grow relatively slow, they look really cool for quite a while before they get into a larger shade tree. And they've got big, whitish-yellow flowers, and they develop into these big, giant, leathery green nuts by the end of the summer. And, I mean, I think they look pretty cool. Some people get annoyed at them because they'll drop all over the yard and whatnot. But
it doesn't produce that many nuts, though, in all honesty. It's not,
it's not as bad as black walnut.
No,
it's not that bad.
This is a really great option for a lot of home lawns, guys, because it's not super tall. The spread is usually only about 30 to 40 feet.
Yeah.
So you can plant it within... 15, 20 feet of your house on center, and that's not going to be an issue. It's going to need some good pruning, but because it's a moderate grower, you might only have to prune it every other year if you actually are pretty diligent about that. That's going to be...
No more than any other tree, really.
It's going to be important, too, because this one can get... They're telling me it gets some powdery mildew on its foliage. I've never seen that with a tree.
And neither have I.
But apparently that can be an issue if you're growing it maybe in full shade and you live in a wet climate, maybe Seattle or something like that.
I could see it being an issue, yeah.
It could definitely develop. So that brings us into the zones.
I see zone 3 to 7. Pretty hardy, widely adaptable. Looks like you might have some troubles in the deep south. You know, I don't know, maybe that's probably... Southern Texas, is getting down past zone 7.
No, I'm
not super familiar with the southern
Texas,
limits of
it.
Yeah.
I'm not really familiar with those either, but yeah, it's definitely not going to like it if it's in a really, really dry environment, but it will tolerate that up until a point.
Mm-hmm. Another really cool thing is the fall color. It ranges from a bright yellow all the way to this deep red, burnt orange, some really cool different colors of fall color. an Ohio Buckeye. Definitely a tree to check out in the fall if you get a chance.
Oh, yeah. It's gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. Mm-hmm. It's got some nice, it's smoother bark on it. It's not rippled, really. It's kind of grayish. It's just a really good tree for a really long time. My parents have one in their yard. It looks great. It's really, it's in the spring, too. When it buds out, it has these monster buds on it. It's so cool. If you have one or you see one, check it out in the spring when it starts to bud out late April, and it is just the coolest thing. Their leaves each have 5 to 7 leaflets that are also pretty big. And so, you know, there's a lot of stuff coming out of those buds.
There's all a lot to pack in into a bud.
So they are really, really big and distinguishable.
Mm-hmm. Another interesting thing to note would be the native range. Pretty much most of eastern North America, with a small section that is, looks like both of the Carolinas and West Virginia are left out of it, and Florida and Louisiana, but otherwise pretty much the entire eastern U.S. going all the way down past Minnesota. So it's got a pretty wide geographic range, naturally, all the way up into Canada even. So that just gives us an idea of how widely adaptable it is as a species. Can grow in wide variety of climates, apparently.
Really cool tree. We encourage you, as always, to just give it a quick Google search. That's really going to help put an image on it for you and help you identify it more in the landscape. And
yeah, it's a great tree. Definitely recommend it.
I think that about wraps it up there. We've hit almost every point on the old Ohio Buckeye. So
yeah, that ends our podcast for the day. Thanks for listening, guys.